Yoga.
Receive
dust. See, we're bodies, mix of love and lust. When love was hard to touch, I toss a prayer your way. Namaste, baby, namaste.
Namaste.
California, land of fantasy and make-believe. It's Sabino Veritas. Featuring host, writer, humorist, experiential mystic, raconteur, and parallel parking expert, Tom Savino. Now, here he is with Sabino Veritas in Wine the Truth, Tom Savino.
Welcome home, everybody. This is Tom Savino with Savino Veritas, coming to you live from Burbank, California. No gripes today. No gripes today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Eleanor Odenheimer, PhD at Southern Methodist University, who is a master of yoga. And she'll be talking today about how yoga and Christianity has blended into a new form, a new branch of the yoga tree. And before you heard our theme song, you heard the wonderful chanting of the saint, in my opinion, the saint, who brought yoga to the Western world. And that person, of course, is Paramahansa Yogananda. And we will be talking more about Paramahansa Yogananda as I'm speaking with Dr. Odenheimer, but also after our talk, we will hear Yogananda talking about some concepts. And there's one thing that Dr. Odenheimer, will be talking about is spirituality and how can you practice yoga if you're a Christian? Is there a problem with that? And she has done much research on that, and we'll be talking about that in just a moment. I want to preface her interview, which is on the phone. She will be on the phone joining us from SMU in Dallas, Texas, Southern Methodist University, where she is a doctor of kinesiology and sports. She's in the sports department, although she will explain what her involvement is with Southern Methodist University. But before we get to Dr. Odenheimer, I want to read a quotation from a Christian mystic, a Benedictine monk, actually a Kamal, let me see if I get this word right here, a Kamaldolese monk. And he was very much into yoga and very much into Christ. And also an interesting book by Thomas Matus, who wrote a book called Yoga and the Jesus Prayer. And he had some problems in trying to find his spiritual identity. And he was having great success with yoga and meditation, the meditation that comes with yoga. And he wondered if it was in conflict with his Christianity and being a monk. And no, the answer was no. It was, in fact, very helpful to develop the deep levels of spirituality that the Christian mystics were trying to achieve. But let me read you this one quotation, which is apropos to what Dr. Odenheimer and I will be speaking about, excuse me, and it's from Bede Griffiths, who is the Camaldolese monk, which is part of the Benedictine order. And B. Griffith said, quote, "There may be another way, but integration of flesh and spirit is Christ's way for us today." And with that quotation, we will segue into our interview with Dr. Ellie Odenheimer. Hello, Dr. Odenheimer. How are you? I hope everything is okay in Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. We'll go to you right now. In 2007, Eleanor Odenheimer and I studied yoga and the teaching of yoga at Yoga at the Village in Glendale, California. Today, Eleanor Odenheimer is now Dr. Odenheimer and teaches at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. She'll be joining us on the phone today from her campus at SMU and talking about corporal beliefs and how they influence physical activity. But before she does that, she's going to tell us a little about the course that she's now teaching, Wellness and Responsibility at SMU.
The personal responsibility and wellness course at SMU is a holistic and kind of a well-rounded approach in looking at wellness. The course overall looks at the well-being, both in college and life after college. So we focus on the role of personal responsibility in coping with college and other transitional periods in our lives. We focus on challenges and opportunities at SMU. So while they're in college, how to deal with time management, stress, dealing with pitfalls related to drugs and alcohol. And we also have a personal finance component to our curriculum. And basically all of this, in addition to looking at wellness in a multidimensional model, we hope to help the kids, or the students, I'm sorry, transition into college life more successfully and also give them tools to live their life in a more well and balanced way after college.
Ellie, that sounds like a very practical and useful course.
Right. I wish I had this course when I was in college.
Eleanor, give us a little bit of your background, please.
I started teaching yoga after our course. I was teaching at CSUN, so Cal State Northridge, and at a wellness center in Northridge as well. And then I had the opportunity to enter the doctorate program in sports studies at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. I kind of carried my interest in yoga into my coursework there.
Ellie, we took our Yoga Alliance teacher training courses at the Yoga at the Village in Kenneth Village, which is a part of Glendale, California. And as you may recall, Eleanor, the area was heavily populated with Armenians, and Armenian folk are the first Christians. I remember Elise Briggs, who was our teacher and the owner of the Yoga at the Village at the time, was telling us how the Armenian people in the neighborhood would come in and have a curiosity about yoga and wondered about how it would affect them and because of their Christianity and if it would in any way be in conflict with their beliefs. I think this is the kind of thing that goes right to the heart of your research, yes?
Exactly. And actually an incident right outside of the studio, I think, planted the seed for my research in looking at the intersectionality between yoga, spirituality, and religion. And I think there was a church right across the street from the studio. I could be wrong, but I think a man approached. I was talking to another classmate after a teacher training session one day, and he asked something to the effect of, "What is this yoga and meditation?" So we started talking to him about yoga and meditation, and he said something to the effect of, "Well, doesn't meditation just invite the devil in?" We talked about, well, if you believe meditation is focusing the mind on one point, what you focus on is your choice. So that could be many different things or something that's significant to you. So we felt that it doesn't empty the mind to invite evil or negativity in. It can do just the opposite. in fact. So I think that one of those apprehensions, like you talked about in this discussion I experienced, made me more curious about what do people do when they see this tension between Christianity specifically, and but still wanting to do yoga, but them being maybe scared or worried about participating in this physical activity and this discipline. So just to kind of delve further into that one conversation, I started looking around and looking at Christian sermons and official letters that had come out from different denominations that were basically preaching either caution for Christians that are practicing yoga or outright saying that Christians shouldn't do it. I think in the early 90s, who was Pope Benedict, and at the time, I think he was a cardinal, he wrote out a letter drafted to bishops, predominantly, I think he was addressing bishops in the U.S., cautioning practitioners in their yoga practice because it could become a cult of the body. You know, the focus of the body would be, or the focus would for the practitioner might be on the body versus, you know, God or Jesus. There have been spiritual leaders or religious leaders in other Christian denominations that just outright say a Christian should not practice yoga. It's antithetical to the faith because it has a history of being tied to Hinduism. So yes, all those experiences and reading of doctrine and dogma led me to try to understand how people reconcile those two positions. And what I found is there's a small community within the larger work and body of yoga practitioners that teach yoga from a Christian framework or within a Christian framework.
Would you say then that their approach to teaching yoga was different than what we learned?
I would say somewhat. I conducted a study with 10 yoga teachers who teach from a Christian perspective. I mean, it's called different things. Some people call it Christ-based yoga. Some people call it Christian-centered yoga. It's called many different things. But what remains fundamental is teaching within this Christian framework. And I interviewed 8 women and 2 men throughout the United States. One person was from Eastern Canada. And just trying to talk to them and understand how they taught, how they experienced how they came to teaching Christian-based yoga, how issues of faith and culture and assimilation into Western culture influenced their teaching, and how, you know, what that looked like in their classes, how it was operationalized, if you will. And just through talking with them, I came up with 4 common themes between them, you know, how they entered into doing yoga and what it looked like when they were actually doing it or teaching, how it was operationalized. And I would say some of the things are common to how one would experience a mainstream yoga class. You know, there's a focus on asana or the physical practice of yoga, the postures probably are the same. I was able to observe and participate in 4 classes just to kind of give me an actual taste versus just talking to people but actually doing it too to see what it's like. And it's very similar, but there are some differences. So you might find in terms of differences, you might hear Christian-based music in the background versus maybe kirtan or what people might label ambient or new age, new wave music. Some people use different language and words in how they teach. So in a traditional or mainstream yoga class, you might hear the teacher end class with the word namaste. The light in me salutes the light in you. One of my teachers said she changes that and closes class with the phrase, the Christ in me salutes the Christ in you. That namaste is about the divine, and she names the divine Christ. So that is an example of a change, if you will, in the language. Some practitioners or some teachers don't like to use the Sanskrit words, so they'll use just English. could happen in a mainstream yoga class as well, where a teacher might just use English. There has been some evidence that there might be a change in even the English interpretation. So, for example, Virabhadrasana 2 in English means warrior 2. But I've also heard in a Christian yoga class the phrase crusading warrior, attaching it to Christian history. Adaptation or even a co-optation of language and how that changes. And that might be very different than what a person would experience in a mainstream yoga class. I use purposeful sampling. So I specifically was seeking out people who taught from a Christian perspective, and they identified as such. I asked, there was somebody I knew who taught from a Christian perspective, and I asked her if she knew other people that may be interested. So I contacted them and kind of used this branching out approach, kind of the snowball effect. Do you know somebody? And then asked them, would you know somebody that would be interested in talking to me? And so forth and so on. So it just kind of grew from there. I was conducting this research while I was at the University of Tennessee, but the participants themselves were from all over. I had 4 from the Southeast U.S., 4 from New England, 1 person was from southwestern portion of the United States, and 1 person was from Eastern Canada.
Dr. Odenheimer, your research revealed 4 themes: gateway, dueling dualities, embodied spirituality, and operationalization. Let's take a look at each if we can. And why don't we start with gateway?
The gateway theme is about how people were first, or the participants were first introduced into yoga. How did they get into it? It's, you know, a pretty simple, straightforward question. 7 out of the 10 people recalled going to their first yoga class in a group fitness setting. And the 3 kind of outliers, if you will, started doing yoga either through books or videos that they were introduced to yoga. So that was just kind of a short. So, for example, one of the participants was a priest, and I gave him the alias or pseudonym Father Andrew. And he said he became interested in yoga about 16, when he was telling me, 16 years prior, after going to a health club, and he had been swimming, but getting bored with swimming. So he peeked his nose into a yoga class, and he saw that this was something new and he wanted to get into, so he joined the class. And that's how it basically began. So that's an example of somebody getting into yoga kind of in a group health fitness setting. And then the second theme, if you will, embodied spirituality, dealt with experiences in which participants felt a body-faith connection. And for example, like I said, I did interviews, so all my kind of examples are qualitative in nature. And one of my participants, Madeline, felt that yoga was an approach that really resonated with her, and she felt like God was in her body, quote unquote, when she did yoga. And to her, she said it felt far more real to her than anything she had learned in churches. So again, it's this kind of connection between body and spirit, if you will. Mm-hmm. And for them, spirit, I would argue, is God, with the Judeo-Christian understanding and definition of God. So that's an example of. Alana was another participant that talked about this embodied spirituality, and she said, quote, you know, I think that for me, no matter what the church said, there is a way in which the teaching of the church has led to a very negative view of human embodiment. And she went on to say, when I do yoga, all of that goes away. And I know that my body is something that was created by God, and it has a deep personal connection with the God spirit, and it's tangible for her. So that's an example of embodied spirituality.
Kelly, Paramahansa Yogananda, who's often credited with bringing yoga to the West, advised yoga practitioners of the West not to abandon their religious beliefs, not to abandon Christianity and Christ. In fact, to practice yoga with Christ as a foundation.
I definitely think that I would argue that they would agree with that. That for them, these participants, this study that I'm talking about, the yoga enhances their Christian faith. And it sounds very similar to what you're talking about, that their faith is deepened through the yoga practice.
Ellie, can you tell us a little about dueling dualities?
Dueling dualities, correct, is the third theme. I broke that into two sub-themes. So to begin looking at universality and connections, that is where participants identified patterns of making philosophical connections between Christianity and yoga, which is, it was a good segue to talk about him into this theme because there's some similarity there. And so in connection with that kind of looking at the dueling dualities, but looking at the universality of yoga, some of the participants felt like there are a lot of connections between yoga and Christianity. For example, one of the participants stated, quote, that yoga is a kind of non-sectarian technology that is, yes, used by Christians, but also obviously by Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, and people of no particular faith. So again, identifying that connection and a universal nature that some people believe yoga has. And then there were others who felt that there are some spaces where Christianity and yoga might not be compatible. So that's where the duality and looking at departures, co-optations, and adaptations might happen. And emphasizing that idea of departing from yoga a little bit, in one of my participants' teacher training manuals. So in addition to talking to people, I also looked at their marketing materials, websites, class observations, so a lot of different data points. And one of my teacher's training manuals, she wrote about how she rejects the notion of karma that is often associated with yoga and also reincarnation. And she noted in her writings that where her training dismounts from traditional or the traditional yoga path is the yogic notion that we are already God. The Christian perspective is that we are reflections of the divine, that God lives in us, but we are not, nor do we claim to be God, but rather God's representatives here on earth, end quote. So for her, you can start to see, well, this is where, you know, I kind of draw a line and say, no, there are some difference between Christianity and yoga, and we take a different path, if you will, in those notions and ideas of karma. Specifically, she talked about karma and reincarnation. So that's kind of the dualities portion.
Well, I find that participant's reaction to karma interesting, in that even an atheist would believe in cause and effect or consequences to actions, which basically is what the definition of karma, what goes around comes around, you might say. Could you explore that a little more and tell us a little bit more about what she might have been thinking?
I don't know, because I didn't go deeply into what she or how she defined karma. But I wonder, and I'm not sure because I don't think I know enough about karma, and maybe you can educate me, but this idea of could it be that some people look at karma as, you know, if something bad or negative happens in your life, it's because you did something bad.
Well, the Dalai Lama, who of course is Buddhist and not Hindu, but the two are very similar in at least in this point on karma. And that is that at any given moment we are engaged in an action or a thought or a behavior that is karmically positive or karmically negative or neutral, having no effect. And these, you know, planting seeds, really, it's kind of the idea of planting seeds, and recommended, of course, to plant the positive seeds as often as possible. But again, as I said, even an atheist would believe in consequences to actions.
And I can appreciate that. And I don't want to speak for her. But I'm wondering if somebody sees, so I use, if somebody is suffering, a person that, or a child has cancer. I mean, I know that's a very extreme example. But somebody might say that the child has not been here on earth long enough to do bad or to promote negative, nor do they know cognitively, you know, in a space to promote one over the other. So I wonder, again, I can't speak for her, but people who are wary of the notion of karma, I wonder if it's an idea like that, like karma can't explain the suffering of people that have done good on Earth.
You know, Ellie, I'm sure everyone knows and agrees that we experience things today that are the effect of what we did yesterday. And that is clear, I think, to everyone of any religion or philosophy. Perhaps this participant was having trouble not so much with karma, but with reincarnation. And it is the seeds of karma. It's what we do in this life. At least this is the philosophy of karma and reincarnation. It is the seeds of what we do in this life that will affect the future life and what we need to learn in that future life that we didn't learn in this life. And also, Ellie, in my studies, researching and reading the Gospels of Mary Magdalene and the Gnostic Gospels and Thomas, the politically incorrect Gospels, not accepted by the church, it does show that Christ believed in reincarnation. I wonder if anybody, any of your participants or in your research, you came across anything about that.
I think it's very interesting. None of my participants in this study spoke to maybe other interpretations of afterlife other than maybe more of the traditional, if you will, Christian view that there's one life that we live here on this earth kind of today, that kind of perspective. And then when we die, then we go through maybe, like I said, a more traditional interpretation and understanding of what, you know, an afterlife might look like, that kind of thing. None of them really spoke to reincarnation, you know, other than the passage I just quoted. There wasn't much talk of and discussion of reincarnation. This is my argument that they don't believe in reincarnation, or it wasn't a salient point for them to bring up in discussing their yoga practice.
Dr. Odenheimer, why don't you tell us, please, about the fourth theme, which is operationalization.
Yes, operationalization of Christian yoga, or yoga taught from a Christian perspective, was the fourth and final theme and addressed one of my objectives in the study. What does this actually look like in reality when somebody's teaching from a Christian perspective? And I approximated how all these layers come together to manifest themselves and what may occur in the participants' classes. And in this theme, it reflects elements that instructors use in their classes in reference to posture, breath, meditation, prayer, and language. And I alluded to language a little bit before with the Virabhadrasana 2 and Crusading Warrior interpretation, the Namaste interpretation, or somebody might change that to conclude class as the Christ in me salutes the Christ in you, or sees the Christ in you, as one participant closes her class. As I mentioned before, I looked at training manuals and different writings and publications of the participants in addition to talking to them. And in one of the training manuals, one of the participants talks about how she ties in Christian scripture and a theme into her classes. So, for example, she might talk about a theme and take her class through some physical postures, which is pretty typical of a mainstream yoga class. But what she felt was different was the spiritual or religious theme that she chose. So she, when I was talking to her about it and asked to give an example, she said, what makes it Christian and what's really important, this is quoting her, what makes it Christian and what's real important is the theme, the spiritual theme that I pick. She's talking about herself. For example, say it's about creating boundaries so that you can open up into your fullest freedom. Then the way I would use that is to enhance the Christian faith is the boundary that we choose is we choose to bind ourselves to Christ and his teaching. And when we do that, then the freedom opens up. So only when we make that connection to him that the fullest freedom in life comes. Then I would talk about how the theme through the talk about the theme through class, so it kind of related to every posture. I would keep talking about the whole thing about binding and freedom, and it would just kind of take that theme deeper into the embodied experience of the student. End quote. So again, it's this in operationalization, the idea is to talk a little bit more about what it would actually look like if somebody was in a Christian-based yoga class. There is not a national governing body of Christian yoga that says, you know, you have to teach this way. But the idea of talking to these 10 participants was just to get an idea of what that might look like. And it's different for each teacher.
Ellie, did you find that churches actually have yoga classes maybe in their parish?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I can't say this church does, but I've seen in church bulletins, like I went to a Catholic mass, I think it was last year, and I saw in the bulletin kind of like an advertisement for a gentle yoga class that they had in their multi-purpose room. So there's definitely space and support from institutions. Like I said, there's some people that say Christians shouldn't do yoga, but there's definitely others that systematically and institutionally support it.
Eleanor, did you find that any particular denomination was more tolerant towards yoga than others?
The denomination of each participant really didn't come up too much. I would say that I think it's interesting there is a Catholic priest, and I want to say his name is Father Thomas Ryan. I really could be wrong about that, but I think he has published some books about yoga from a Christian perspective and pairs different poses with prayers. So that's, I think that's interesting. Yes, it's Thomas Ryan. Sorry, I just had a blank there for a minute. But one of his books in the back has Our Father, the Lord's Prayer, paired to different asana. So that's an example, like I said, of... I wouldn't say like all Catholic priests are publishing books about, you know, doing yoga with the Lord's Prayer, especially when I said back in the 90s, you had a former, who now is a former pope, but saying, you know, you got to be careful when you do it. Maybe the more liberal Christian denominations might be the ones offering yoga in their multi-purpose rooms on a Wednesday night. There are certain denominations that might be more conservative, speaking out against it. So those would, you know, not be obviously hosting a yoga class, in their church. So it probably just depends on the denomination and also the church, because obviously we know even within certain denominations, you're going to have more liberal churches and liberal congregants than in others.
Dr. The sociologist Berdue talks about the ritual appropriations theory. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. There are two different concepts and people working. So Berdue was a French sociologist. And ritual appropriation, also referred to ritual as ritual proximity, was work and is work that Clausen develops and continues to work on. Berdue, in trying to understand yoga from a Christian's perspective a little bit more, more from a theoretical foundation, so we kind of talked about some four themes and very concrete examples of what a Christian-based yoga class would look like. The theoretical frameworks from Berdue, and again, ritual appropriation, help explore the phenomenon a little more deeply from a sociological perspective. So, for example, Berdue did a lot of work with age agency and structure dynamics. So how much does an individual have their own capacity to shape their reality, and how much of someone's reality shaped by structures, those things around them.
So Berdue's acknowledgement of both structure and agency lends insight to these teachers' experiences, the ones, I would argue, the ones in the study. And it offers a more nuanced appreciation of individual power and constraining culture, and illuminates how the instructors may construct their own reality within the confines of yoga, which itself is a socio-historically positioned practice. So taking all of these into account, all of the participants acknowledged yoga's connection to Eastern religion. That wasn't disputed. You know, its history and its connection to Hinduism and to another extent Buddhism. And this is a cultural constraint within which they are operating and teaching their classes. Yet these instructors actively engage in their own agency by adapting the practice and operationalizing it in a Christian perspective. So that gives you a little bit of an example of how Berdue's work on agency and structure helped us to understand how Christian yoga, or yoga taught from a Christian perspective, operates in our culture. Then the ritual appropriation or ritual proximity, which is drawn on work from Clausen, helps to critically interrogate the findings or the discussions I had with these participants at the intersectionality of spirituality, religion, and physical activity. Obviously here, the physical activity is yoga. And basically, Clausen's work looked at, so I drew on some of her work that looked at how, what she labeled was liberal, Christians use ritual proximity to bring together symbols, acts, and memories from various times and cultures, thus constructing new lineages of religious inheritance within webs of Christian ritual. And that's a passage from her work on ritual proximity. And by teaching yoga, so speaking more specifically to teaching yoga from a Christian perspective, by naming yoga as universal, so looking again back at that, the connections and universality between yoga and Christianity, participants are able to, again, teach this discipline within a framework that works for them. And where they choose to depart from yoga's perceived Hindu associations, the instructors are able to adapt and transmute the practice, again, to fit in a framework that works for them. So through the lens of ritual appropriation and ritual proximity, it can be argued that Christian yoga teachers, or teachers who teach from a Christian perspective, are not just teaching any other group fitness class, but they're creating a new lineage within the yoga community itself. So if you think of yoga kind of as a tree, and historically it started back in the Indus Valley and moved up through the Vedic and Brahmin times. And then you have all these offshoots and branches of modern yoga that we might call Iyengar yoga and power yoga and Kundalini yoga. Some would argue that Christian-based yoga is this another offshoot or another more modern branch of yoga. And that, again, kind of draws upon this Christian, or I'm sorry, ritual proximity theory and concept.
Ellie, as you know, there are so many different types of yoga. My introduction to yoga was simply from a class called Hatha Yoga. And so many classes are just called Hatha Yoga. But there's Ashtanga Yoga and Iyengar Yoga. And over the years, I've practiced all of them, many of them, and have acclimated towards one or the other during different times of my life. Now I'm finding that the yoga that resonates with me is Kundalini yoga. And interesting, I think it is, I wouldn't say more spiritual, but the thing that I like about it, Ellie, is that it incorporates mantra and more of the Hindu beliefs, I feel, than the physical Hatha yoga, just the so many of the yoga classes which are just for physical activity. So Kundalini resonates with me because of the spirituality of it, as well as the physical benefits and energetic benefits. But I think many of the mainstream people in America, people in the West, find Kundalini maybe is a little off-putting because it has the mantras and the a little more of a ritualistic environment than the other forms of Hatha yoga. But the irony of it for me, Ellie, is that I was introduced to Kundalini yoga through the YMCA.
Yeah, and it's interesting because some people who claim that yoga is indebted to other faiths, maybe Hinduism or even yoga that kind of is, like you're saying, a little bit more attached to ancient traditions, might be marginalized by either Christian-based yoga or mainstream yoga, where the focus might be just on asana or the physical practice. So then it's just interesting who gets legitimized, if you will, in the marketplace, in the spiritual marketplace, if you will. And yoga is part of that.
Ellie, what sort of yoga are you practicing these days and teaching at SMU?
It's just to name my biggest influences right now, because right, you're talking about Kundalini, and my biggest influences right now are probably Iyengar and Ashtanga yoga. Definitely Iyengar is a big influence right now. The kind of system I came into at Southern Methodist University and the curriculum they teach under is more under the power yoga, which fall under that, or be off that branch if we continue on with yoga, yoga's family tree as our analogy of the day. Power yoga has been a established method or discipline here, so I kind of fused that with Iyengar a little bit in my teaching.
Ellie, I ran off a list of many different kinds of yoga that I've practiced and that people practice here in the West, but I think you would agree with me that if you are a person who is thinking about embarking on the yoga journey, you might consider starting with Iyengar yoga. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I totally agree with that statement.
And for those of you who are not familiar at all with Iyengar yoga, you will basically learn every pose exactly the way it should be. You will know every pose thoroughly.
More than you might ever want to.
Yes.
I agree. I totally agree. I think Iyengar yoga provides an amazing foundation of practice.
Coincidentally, Ellie, I remember when I studied Iyengar yoga that we would begin each class with a recitation of a prayer to Patanjali, a sort of mantra-like prayer. And many of the students, I remember, were put off by that as if it were some sort of foreign element that they should not be involved with.
I can't say I use that in my teaching, but yes, I have been in classes and people are kind of looking out like one eye open and one eye closed and saying, what are they saying?
Being introduced to Patanjali in Iyengar, I became interested and studied him. And I find that Patanjali and his Yoga Sutras and what he's espousing in the Yoga Sutras is completely consistent with the teachings of Christ. Would you care to comment on that, Ellie?
I think that while some people might see, especially when you get, if you look at the eight limbs that he outlines in the Yoga Sutras and you get towards the end, maybe dealing with Samadhi and Pratyahara and some of the movements or phases of moving towards meditation, I agree. I don't see a discord between the two, but I feel like, especially when talking about Samadhi, some participants might feel like, from my study, some did not see any discord between. They might say Samadhi is Christ. There isn't a discord, while others might see some tension between the two. And I think it's kind of going back to what you're studying and what you're reading and what people's interpretation of Samadhi is.
Could you enlighten the listeners a little more about what Samadhi is? How would you define Samadhi?
That is a very good question. So again, it depends on who you're reading and interpretations of who you're reading. I look just at Samadhi as the complete absorption, if you will, in what you're meditating on. So I kind of cycle or circle back to that reference, that story I made at the beginning of our conversation about the gentleman who approached a classmate of mine and I and said, doesn't meditation and yoga invite the devil? And I would say, well, you know, your dharana, or, you know, your focal point is your choice. So I think that's where participants don't see discord between, I'm speaking for them a little bit at this point, but they don't see discord between meditating on Christ or maybe a virtue or a teaching of Jesus. Because samadhi becomes a complete absorption into Christ or that which they're focusing on.
We are talking on the phone with Dr. Eleanor Odenheimer at SMU, Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. And I want to thank you so much for all that you've talked about yoga and Christianity and the embodiment of one's religious beliefs and how that is expressed physically. And I want to get a little more into what you're doing at SMU. Are you actually in the sports department at SMU?
Not athletics. I'm not sure if that's what you mean. Some people, when they say sports, they might think athletics, football, basketball, volleyball, that kind of stuff. So I'm not. I'm in an academic unit of applied physiology and wellness. We do have sport management in our curriculum, but again, it falls under the auspices of an academic unit, not athletics, of what you see on television. I teach, it's a physical activity course, so the students are required to take a physical activity course, so it falls under that curriculum. It is, this one that I'm teaching this semester is very much asana-based. We do open with about 5 minutes of pranayama or so in the beginning and go through an asana practice. And then the end concludes with, you know, a traditional shavasana and kind of, again, movement or space to move into meditation. So it's probably pretty, I would say, mainstream, you know, in a yoga studio along those lines. I really like Iyengar's, Light on Pranayama by Iyengar. I like that sequence because I only have the students for 15 to 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I like it because it gives kind of a week by week guide and just moves them through some very simple, gentle points. And it's also modified because his coursework, you know, works you up to 10, 15, 20 minutes of breath work, and we are doing 5. So, again, it's just to me, I hope to plant some seeds as they, maybe some of them are exposed to yoga for the first time through my yoga class. I'm hoping to plant seeds of a personal practice or them practicing yoga beyond my semester with them. There's a little bit of weaving in, we talked about the 8 limbs of yoga for 2 seconds a moment ago. So there's a little bit of that philosophy in there. One time we had, and our teacher training, Carl Dawson was one of our facilitators, and he said something to the effect, I wish I could like really quote him, but he was like, give them a little history, a little pranayama, a little Sanskrit, and send them on their way. And I kind of do that. I'm not heavy on the philosophy. They're 19, 20 years old.
Yeah.
90% of them are not in my class for that. So I want them to keep on coming back. Give them some sense of maybe the philosophy and history and the Sanskrit a little bit. So there's a little bit of that effort throughout the class during the semester as well. I just want them to find the path that works for them, whether it be spiritual or physically active. I think you need all those things to be, again, I reference that course, the personal responsibility and wellness course that I'm teaching. And part of that is, you know, a spiritual wellness, a physical wellness. So I hope they just, you know, and maybe it's not through yoga that they find those things, it's through other avenues, but
yeah.
I'm happy to plant the yoga seeds if they take root in them, in the students.
Well, Dr. Eleanor Odenheimer, is there anything else that you would like to discuss before we wrap it up?
Just to speak a little bit more, I don't know if I was detailed enough, the course that we're teaching, or the wellness course, it's the required course that we're teaching here at Southern Methodist University. And it, again, all the students have to go through it, and it takes a more holistic approach looking at wellness. So we look at social, physical, environmental, career and wellness, as well as intellectual, spiritual, and financial wellness. So these eight different components. And I just kind of wanted to, I don't need to go into detail unless you have more questions for me. I'm happy to answer it. I just kind of wanted to give a little more specificity to the kind of well-rounded nature of the curriculum. So that people, when they think about wellness, it's not just about what you eat and working out, but there is a spiritual element and all these other dimensions that kind of overlap.
Ellie, there is a phrase that I see here that I would like you to talk about, if you could. Spiritual marketplace. Can you talk on that a little bit?
Sure. In short, I think there is a movement in our culture towards spirituality and the marketability of it. So that could be kind of self-help books that are spiritual in nature. That is yoga being promoted as not just, again, a physical modality, but that it has a spiritual dimension so that you connect. It's an avenue that you might connect to God or a higher power as you know it. So that would be a very, again, short example of yoga in kind of the spiritual marketplace, if you will. Does that kind of answer your question? And, you know, there's, like I said, there's different manifestations. It could be yoga. It could be a church having basketball class, you know, leagues and baseball leagues for the kids, so that sport is happening, physical activity is happening, but it's happening, again, under the auspices of a church. So you see programs like that. That might be another example of kind of, that's more religious maybe than spiritual, because, you know, we have some different definitions between religion and spirituality, but there's overlap between the two. So that might be another example. There's retreats, you know, where people are working on spiritual themes, and yoga retreats where you go away to these exotic places to meditate and to do yoga all day and eat great food. So all of those would be examples to me of packaging spirituality and outwardly marketing it so people can consume. Sydney, you know your neighborhood, it used to be your neighborhood's changing when you got a Starbucks, and now it's when you get a yoga studio. So, yeah, there seems to be a lot of yoga studios to take classes. Gyms have it, which is pretty typical. I found a small group of Iyengar students to practice with. There's probably about five of us, and I've been practicing with them and the same teacher for the 2.5 years or so since I got here. So I haven't really immersed myself. I kind of found my little group and have stuck with it, and that's kind of my home base.
Well, Doctor, I also see on your resume here that one of your two bachelor degrees is from Louisiana State University. And I believe you were raised perhaps in New Orleans. Could you tell us about that? That's an interesting place with a lot of blends and a lot of spirituality. Tell us about that.
Guys, I haven't lived there in a very long time. Yes, all my extended family is there.
Well, that's great. You get to...
Uncles, cousins, grandmothers, So always a reason to go back, which is always welcome.
There's so many cultures there that are just mixed in with kind of like a stew almost.
And it's funny, we were just talking about that last night because Mardi Gras is carnival right now. At dinner we were talking about that and how the mix and how the different manifestations of that and what that looks like in the city.
Dr. Eleanor Odenheimer, how can I thank you? I want to thank you so much. It was really enjoyable. And it was very enlightening.
Thank you. It was great talking to you. I had fun. Fear of the manifest, waging battle on my spirit. Surrender to what's fearless. See what bodies mix of love and lust. When love was hard to touch, I toss a prayer your way. Namaste, baby, namaste. Namaste.
Our thanks to Dr. Eleanor Odenheimer for her time and knowledge and passion of the subject of yoga and Christianity. And remember now, she's a professor at SMU. And if you are listening at SMU right now, I think you should enroll in her classes immediately, if not sooner.
This is Tom Savino, and you're listening to Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California, and we are going to break away now for the news in Canada.
Good evening, Tom. Historic Unionville has suffered a major fire. The historic Queen's Hotel, built in the 1860s, was ablaze for 3 hours as passersby watched in horror. Police wanted international hunt for a Bolton resident. Authorities claim Daniel Ranieri fled a York Regional Police investigation into what could be illegal dealings related to Cuba. And Vaughan politicians vow to keep Spadina on track. This comes after Toronto Mayor John Tory mused about the new extension, stopping short of York Region. Flurries of rain in the forecast. North plus 4 plus 7 at Pearson. This update is brought to you by Frank Atola, 1148.ca. Frank lays down the laws. More at 1148.ca/Frank. I'm Philip Hong, and now back to Tom Savino with Savino Veritas on SRN1.
Thank you, Phil, for that news report in Canada. Let's join Paramahansa Yogananda with the Om Prayer.
Temple of silence. Remaining in the castle of peace, Listeners may have their tough questions answered. Through the universal synchronicity of Manjushri, seer of all past, present, and future, Gurgin Yeshe reads your questions and throws the dice for you. More importantly, he'll answer your questions based on Manjushri's guidance, which Yeshe will invoke for your reading. The price? $22. Submit $22 to PayPal and one well-thought-out question to tjsavino22@gmail.com.
Should I go to college or not?
What's the best way to advertise my business?
Can I trust my boyfriend to be faithful?
What's the best month for the wedding, May or June?
Will I ever get pregnant?
Who's the best candidate to fill a supervisor's job? May I count on my best pitcher to win this game?
How much should I gamble at the casino?
Do I need to go see the doctor about this condition?
Is Atlanta the right place for me to move?
Should we increase our homeowner's insurance?
If I get the job, will it help our relationship?
Will marital therapy keep us together?
Where should I look for my lost ring?
Will I ever find it? Can I?
Can I?
Should he?
Should he?
Will they?
Will they?
When will?
Will.
Can.
Can.
Questions.
Questions.
Money.
Love.
French enemies. Mo.
Mo.
Mo. Tibetan divination.
Yoga. You've been listening to Yoga Special of Savino Veritas, No Gripes Today. Be back with us next Thursday, 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, where you'll hear the fine gripes of select, I'm sorry, the fine wine of select gripes on Savino Veritas. We're going to close now with Namaste.
Bodies, mix of love and lust. When love was hard to touch, I toss a prayer your way. Namaste, baby, namaste.
Namaste, 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 nation.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.